Thank you, Eric. Ladies and gentlemen, I believe we live in a world of contradiction. For example, we've got in our world we have got plenty, and yet amidst that plenty of poverty, a real contradiction. And often it's a simple illustration or simple analogy that throws some light into the nature of the problem. And I'm reminded of a statement you may have heard by one of our professors in Western Australia, the late Professor Murdoch, who spoke in the 30s, and of course that was a time of extreme poverty and plenty. And he made the very pertinent observation that the situation then was like a man dying of thirst in a freshwater lake. And I hope that our speaker will throw some reasons onto why we have a situation that's very similar to that, like that today. Our next speaker, Mr. Jeremy Lee, spent much of his early life in East Africa and Kenya, except for a period where he was educated in England. He subsequently migrated to West Australia and eventually joined the League of Rights. He is a prolific writer, author, lecturer, and he's presently the National Secretary of the Economic Division of the League, and he publishes a well-known quarterly called Enterprise. He is also Assistant National Director of the Australian League of Rights. He is very sought after, and his demands for lectures are becoming almost unbearable, and it's very hard for him to keep up with it. And I think it's your great privilege this afternoon to find out why that is so. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Jeremy Lee to speak on the world economic crisis.
Well, Mr. Chairman and ladies and gentlemen, I'd like first of all to start by saying what a privilege it is to follow so lucid a speaker as the one that we've heard, Ron Gostick, a man who I believe in time will be marked as one of the great figures of this period of history in the English-speaking world. And secondly, I'd like to say how inadequate I feel to fill the gap left by the absence of Michael Hoffman. I have never met him, but I have already been tremendously impressed by his material, and his little newsletter Focus, I believe, will make a dramatic impact in the United States before we're very much older. So it's nevertheless a privilege, and it really is a thrill to be able to come here to this gathering and to be a guest speaker at this seminar, which is really gaining quite a reputation throughout Australia, and I think there are many here from interstate who look forward to this occasion, not simply for the company, but also for the quality of the information that is provided. Now, I always feel slightly diffident about being billed to speak on the world economic crisis, because in the 20-odd years that I've been going around lecturing, it seems to have fallen to my lot to have spoken more on economics than any other particular subject, and I have no claim to being an economist. I may rise in your esteem as soon as I say that. I hope so, because economists these days don't seem to have a very good reputation. But if we think of the fact that economics, in its simplest term, is a Greek word which means housekeeping, and that housekeeping, even for a family, from a family to a community, to a state, to a nation, involves both the production of goods and services and the consumption of the same. The best economists in any nation, I'm convinced, are housewives. And really, if we could only get all those officials out of the Treasury and get some housewives in there, we'd solve our problems fairly quickly. And if at the same time we made those experts in our treasuries do a little budgeting for a normal family, they might find the reality of trying to stretch a dollar to cover the space that a $2 is required to fill. So it's practical things that we're concerned about today. And I would say if we can get anything out of or what we need to do to try and grasp what is really happening economically is to divest ourselves of some of the enormous gobbledygook that is spoken about economics, or to try and put it another way, if we could get the scales taken away from our eyes to see the fundamentals of true economics. And my own opinion is we operate in an environment where there are two totally separate and distinct economic systems. One is hidden behind the other, one is obscured. The first one that we see the whole time is man-made economics, which has become almost a superstitious mess of voodooism. And we have phrases which I'm quite convinced even the exponents don't really understand, from slumpflation to stagflation, to cooling to squeezing, to freezing, to heating, to liquidity, to bear markets, to bull markets. And most of us think, well, if anybody can understand that, they're either saints or they're very deep sinners. But behind that, we have natural economics. Natural economics, in my understanding, is God's economy. And God's economy is so simple that it requires a true type of vision to see it. It's like the emperor's new clothes. I think all economists now spend their lives describing this mythical suit that the emperor is wearing, and it takes little children to see the fact that really there are no clothes on that emperor. God's economics is a world of fantastic beauty and abundance. Provision here not only for those that live on this earth, but also for probably 5 or 6 or 7 times the size of the populations that do actually exist. More and more evidence is now coming out, presented by great authorities. Rush Dooney is one of the recent ones on the myth of the world overpopulation explosion, which has been used as a factor to coerce people into economic straitjackets, the like of which really are completely idiotic. So if I can do something to try and provide a glimpse, inadequate though it might be, of what we call God's economy, well, I believe I will have served my purpose, and that's my hope. The first thing I want to say is that having gone round for all this time, I've earned something of a reputation, and I'm normally referred to as a prophet of doom or a Jeremiah of gloom. I don't know where they got the word Jeremiah, but I've seen it quoted in papers right across Australia. He's a guy who's always telling us that there's some crisis coming way ahead. Well, I've been relieved of that burden during the last year, because we've got an amazing situation where every paper now reporting on international economics is talking about the approaching world crisis. We've just had, for example, a gathering of 300 top economists and bankers in the United States and America discussing one simple question: is the crisis going to break in 1988 or is it going to break in 1989? There is no dispute about the fact that it's coming. There is simply a dispute about actually when it is going to break, and everybody is hinging on being able to pick that, so that in some cases they hope to make a profit out of this great world crisis that is coming. And therefore, I suppose in a sense I'm now more optimistic than those who at one stage were calling me the Jeremiah of doom, or the Jeremiah of gloom, or whatever it was. I believe we're on the edge, not of an aversion of that disaster, but a breakthrough in understanding of enormous proportions, and it's beginning to happen. But you might have heard that story or read that book by George Orwell, Animal Farm, which has many potent messages in it. It is the story, it's a satire of a group of animals that overthrow the farmer in the belief that they're going to establish a much more peaceful and more equal type of society. And so they organize a revolution on the farm, and away goes Mr. Jones, who's sent out of the place. He becomes an exile, and the animals take over, and they're going to run this on lines of perfect equality. And they have marvelous, high-sounding, idealistic slogans that they write on the barn door. All animals are equal, it says there. And whether you're a cart horse or whether you're a sheep, you're convinced that's absolutely right. And then inevitably, of course, one group of animals gets to the top, and the pigs, with all the glibness that pigs have, manage to persuade the other animals that we need management, and they have been peculiarly suited to management, and in the end, they are living in Farmer Jones's house while all the poor other animals sweat it out or freeze to death down in the barn. And down there in the barn, they have arguments. They try and remember what it was like before the pigs were up there in the top house. Was Farmer Jones as bad as they made out, or was he worse? Were things better in the old days, or were they worse? But they do notice one thing, that whenever things get worse, there's always a set of statistics proving that really it's all getting better. So whenever you see politicians making a statement that things are on the improve, or that the corner has been turned, or the lights are coming on, start flinching for the next blow. That is my sound advice to you all. Now, we've just had in this country the budget, which is heralded with tremendous speculation, and then interpreting. It's like a new school of theology interpreting the budget. And in the meantime, our treasurer has departed the country for a while, and at this precise moment, he's addressing a gathering of the International Monetary Fund. I think it's in Tokyo, but I'm not quite sure about that. Well, we might just think somewhat about what Paul Keating's on about, because he's left us now to discuss the budget, which has been completely misconstrued by the media, quite deliberately, I think. But it was this time last year, on this precise date, or 2 days earlier, the 3rd of October, 1986, that Paul Keating was actually addressing another group, and this time in the United States. And the article came out in the Financial Review, which said this: in a speech to the annual meeting of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank, he said the United States' $100 billion trade surplus of those two countries, this is Japan and West Germany, alone was equal to America's current account deficit this year. Later, and this is the point I want to make, addressing the Council for Foreign Relations, he unveiled his optimistic message about the government's current economic policy here in Australia, which he hopes will sway sentiment about Australia's medium-term economic outlook. Mr. Keating emphasized that the changes underway to improve competitiveness and manage the effects of the sharp decline in terms of trade were widely supported by the Australian community. Now, that was exactly 1 year ago today, and in the meantime, in order to try and endorse or to try and drive home to this prestigious organization, the Council for Foreign Relations, just how strongly the Australian people supported him, he quoted two. The first one he quoted was, of course, one of our own kith and kin, a guy by the name of Rupert Murdoch. And exactly 2 days later, The Age came out, which said this: Hawks doing great, Murdoch tells United States. They were the elite of Australia's new capitalists, the movers and shakers, the kings of the takeover game, the fledgling Australian multinationals, and they had come to tell Wall Street that Australia was a good thing to invest in. John Elliott had flown all the way from Melbourne in 3 hours of sleep and 24 hours of hiccups, but he could still get it together enough to explain how Elders had gone multinational thanks to the great beer, the cheap Aussie dollar, and a philosophy of having the optimist running the business and the pessimist doing the accounting. So we had Rupert Murdoch and Mr. John Elliott telling the Americans what a tremendous job the Hawke government was doing at the time that we were meeting last year. And Hawke, who is certainly not, he's not backward in grasping these things, shortly afterwards, this article came out in the Weekend Australian. In fact, actually, this was only 4 weeks ago. Hawke swoops on Elliott's tribute. The Prime Minister, Mr. Hawke, last night embarrassed the opposition by seizing on a published article by the Federal Treasurer of the Liberal Party, Mr. John Elliott, which heaps praises on the Australian economy. Does it seem incongruous to you that when they go over to the United States, they take Rupert Murdoch and John Elliott to persuade the Americans that the Hawke government is doing a tremendous job back here in this country, but when they come back here, John Elliott is touted as the one man possible to defeat the Hawke government and therefore should be put in charge of the new revamped opposition that they're hoping to get together. Now, there is media for you. There's brilliant persuasion. Be that as it may, Paul Keating then presented his budget to the Australian people, which was eulogized right throughout the media as a miracle budget. Miracle because he had apparently managed to reduce the deficit down to $27 million. Forget all the results of trying to get there. Forget the five farmers a day who've been walking off bankrupt properties, or the thousands of little businesses that have gone crashing down into oblivion, or the families that are getting crushed, or the young people trying to own their own homes who without any choice have been hit by higher interest rates and higher mortgage costs. That is of no account. He has used the agony of those people to reduce the deficit down to $27 million, and that was hailed right throughout the media as a miracle. Well, I want to tell you something about the miracle. The miracle was nonsense, because what Paul Keating has done is to take Australia to the highest tax, the second highest tax point in Australia's history. And if you just look over the tax takes since the Hawke government has been in, I would like to read the figures to you. Total taxation taken by the Hawke government in 83-84 was $56,000 million. 1 year later, $63,000 million. The next year, $69,000 million. The next year after that, 86-87, $74,000 million. And miracle of miracles, 87-88, $78.1 million. He's gone from $56,000 million to $78,000 million in the 4 years that the Hawke government has been running this place. And that is heralded as a miracle. Well, if that isn't creative media, I'd like to know what is. And that raises the next question. Why did we have this completely uncritical heaping of praise on that budget? And the reason was, just after it was taken, I beg your pardon, just before this article came out in the Australian, the Weekend Australian, August the 29th to the 30th. Remember, this is, I think, 10 days before the budget. The headline, Hawke, Keating and Crean to sell us to Wall Street. Hawke, Keating and Crean to sell us to Wall Street. And they've got to have a good set of figures in the pocket, which simply is, that's all they're interested in, the deficit. And the second thing is they've got to have a eulogistic media which says that they're a miracle government to go and be able to do it. It was so sickening and so appalling that the only person who told us the truth about the budget was one of Paul Keating's fellow cabinet ministers. And very embarrassing, out came the Australian just afterwards, September the 27th, Walsh warns of International Monetary Fund intervention in Australia if we don't wake up. Now, who's Walsh? He is Senator Peter Walsh from West Australia, formerly a wheat farmer from Doodlakine, I think he came from. And he is bluntly saying, our debt system is so appalling and the budget has been so misinterpreted and oversold that we are in danger of International Monetary Fund intervention if we don't start speaking the truth. Now, it seems to me incredible that you can get a budget presented by a socialist government with no media criticism of it, and the only genuine criticism you can get is from a fellow socialist in that cabinet who begins to tell us something of the truth. And that's just where we are at the present time. All this is being set for the selling of Australia internationally. And the selling of Australia internationally, I'd like to just take you through some of the patterns, starts with an article which came out in 1986 November. This would be 11 months ago, and this was a feature article in The Australian by the guy who quite obviously is the front runner journalist to explain the lies the Labour Party wants explained to Australia, Paul Kelly. If you want to find out what the current government line is that we're supposed to believe, you read Paul Kelly. He's got it in every time. And this article was on the difficulties that Paul Keating was facing, but he contained one sentence that just struck me. National sovereignty in the pure form is an obsolete concept. Australia can no longer determine its own fate in the world. The political and economic challenge now more than ever before is to read the world trend and adapt. This is the challenge for Mr. Hawke and Mr. Howard. Well, with that tucked under their belts, what is the program now developing internationally? And the program developing internationally is a program which I've already spoken about considerably over the last few months, but we're going to hear more and more of it. and it's a program called Debt for Equity Swaps. Now, Debt for Equity Swaps is simply the mechanism to realize the new international economic order. That is the shifting of all economic power out of national sovereignties into an embryonic world government that is being put into place brick by brick at the present time. And Debt for Equity Swaps wasn't heard in Australia this time last year. In fact, the early part of 1986, it was a program being assiduously sold to third world American, Latin American countries. And they went to Chile, and they went to Brazil, and Ecuador, and Peru, and the Argentine, and they said, these are the international banking groups, Wall Street Eskimos, and they said to those nations, you have got such huge debts that you cannot pay. We are no longer going to lend you any money to pay the interest you owe us. So what we will do is to offer you a deal, and the deal is called Debt for Equity Swaps. We'll scrub some of the debt, or even all the debt, if you will give us the title deeds to your industries. And this sounded tremendous to nations which were having revolutions inside their own countries of starving people who'd been put into that situation by the attempt to pay the debts. You see, they had accepted what Australia was told to accept during the last depression by Nathaniel Guggenheimer Gregory and Sir Otto Niemeyer, and some of you amongst you would remember that, when they came out to Australia and said, the bank in London must be paid before the Australian people eat. So that was the program, and they were keen to get into it. The first to start negotiating a deal was Brazil. A debt for equity swap. Take our industries. Here are the title deeds. Just write the debt off. That was followed by Chile under Pinochet. Chile went to the Wall Streeters and said, would you do a debt for equity swap deal with us? And he was told, yes, we're interested, but before we come in, we want you to introduce inside your country a program called privatization. It is not good if we are seen to be taking over the government directly. You privatize your industries and your utilities and those sort of functions, and we will then come in, take the title deeds, and we'll scrub part of the debt. So privatization became the in thing in Chile. It's the in thing in another country at the moment. I just can't quite remember which. But I suppose if you're going to sell Australia to Wall Street, you've got to have privatization as part of the deal. Very interesting, isn't it? And then all of a sudden, one nation woke up. That was the nation of Peru. And they said, this is ludicrous. I think they had had a little glimpse of reality. They said, if this goes on, what's going to happen is we will be living in Peru, but we won't own any of it. So we don't think that's really fair. What we'll do is we will pay 10% of our exports in debt service and not a cent more. If our exports go up, you're going to get a little bit more money. If they go down, you're going to get less. But that's the limit, take it or leave it. And the bankers were horrified. That was totally unprecedented. In fact, they used the phrase, it's not cricket. To which the Peruvians replied, what is cricket? What is this cricket thing? Well, they looked it up in the dictionary, and they said to the international bankers, we think what you've been doing to us isn't cricket either. Be that as it may, we're not paying. And immediately, the whole of Latin America began to watch what was going to happen in Peru. Would the banks invade? Well, they hadn't got an army at that moment. So they ran around the world, wringing their hands and saying this wasn't cricket. Well, you can only say that so many times. And so now they have a club of nations in Latin America called the Cartagena Group, who are all looking with great interest at some technique or mechanism to tell the bankers to go whistle. Brazil has totally suspended payments on interest for a while. And other nations are following suit. Bolivia has done this. Uruguay has done this. And this is now attracting interest not only in Latin America, but right round in other parts of the third world. There's only one snag to it, and that is the spokesman for this Cartagena group is a leader in that part of the world by the name of Fidel Castro. And I've been picking up some of the speeches that Fidel Castro has made on the world debt crisis. And he says, in the speeches he makes, the figures he quotes are absolutely 100%. It's tremendous stuff. Tremendous stuff. He goes right through. He says to these nations, those fat monopoly capitalist bankers have got you. You've got to fight back. Don't be swallowed up. When President Reagan comes down through our part of the world claiming that he's fighting a communist takeover, that's not the truth at all. He's just a policeman for the international bankers. And there's more than a half truth in that, you know. So that is the, and it's rather embarrassing to find Fidel Castro saying much the same as I believe. There's only one difference. He says, there's the problem, but the answer to that problem is a program called the New International Economic Order. Let's all join and fight for that, and we'll defeat the bankers for all time. He doesn't tell those nations, the same bankers who have got them gripped in impossible debt, have also worked through bodies like the Trilateral Commission and the Bilderbergers to set up this phony solution which Castro is leading them into. He's simply leading them out of one trap into another trap spun by the same spider. While all this was going on, over in the Philippines, Corazon Aquino had suddenly realized that she had the same problems. Although Marcos had departed, the problems hadn't, and the major problem was the huge Philippine debt. So she hopped on a plane this recent May and went to America, and she begged them almost, would you do a debt for equity swap deal with us? And the Americans said, sure, only too keen. How many title deeds have you got in your briefcase? And they did a deal. They signed a legal agreement. And she came back filled with joy that something had been done, got off the plane at Manila Airport onto the bitumen, and was met by one member of her government who said, hold it a moment, President Aquino. Haven't you heard what they're doing down in Peru? And she said, what's that? They said, they're actually telling the bankers to go whistle. Well, she said, if they can do that, perhaps we can. And she just took that agreement and ripped it in half. And I have a strange feeling that the political pressure on President Aquino has increased immeasurably since that point. There could even be a revolution there that tipped her out. And you wonder where the revolutionaries, who are all supposed to be communists, are getting their guns and their armaments and their organization from. So you see, if you buck the system, you are in trouble. And right around the world, debt for equity swaps became a... It was a discussed and feared program with a great deal of understanding, all with the exception of a nation called Australia. Now, we need to look very carefully at what is happening in this country, and I want to go through a number of, which I've just been putting into sequence recently, a number of reports that are very interesting. The first thing is an article that came out in the West Australian well over 10 years ago, May the 8th, 1975, and the headline was, Multinationals Could Be the New Global Power. And the article then goes on to say that power is shifting out of governments into the hands of a small number of multinationals who had already controlled one quarter of the total world's production at that time. 1975, remember that. Well, 1975 was exactly 1 year after the United Nations Sixth General Assembly had actually come out with an official declaration for the new international economic order. This was the program for world government, heralded by both capitalist and communist nations as the solution to the world's problems. July the 8th, 1987, this article came out in the Australian, Farm Trusts May Be the Key to the Recovery. And listen to this, 10 years after that first article, which they said in that article, this was a danger. This is what it says this time. Australia's rural property industry is on the brink of a recovery which will lead the country into the 21st century, according to the National Director of Accountants, Deloitte, Haskins and Sells, Mr. Phil Ruthven. Mr. Ruthven said Australia's farming community would be radically altered in the next decade and the existing 170,000 farms would be slashed to under 100,000. Now, to move into the next decade, remember, is only 2 years' time. Mr. Ruthven said large operations in I beg your pardon, where are we? Rural land prices already showing signs of recovery would soar as Australia readjusted to corporate farming in all sectors of agriculture, he said. Mr. Ruthven said large operations in Australian agriculture would be run by farmers leasing land from billion-dollar property trusts with interests at all levels of primary industry. Up to 200 rural property trusts would come on to the market within the next 5 years, with a combined asset value of $5,000 million. July, that's 2 months ago. Well, the word began to get round. You see, while the crisis was at its deepest in the rural areas, nobody was really too interested in buying properties at that time. They were waiting for a recovery. The recovery has started in one sector, the wool industry, and sugar prices look slightly better. The sugar farmers are in no position to take advantage of it because they are so deeply in debt and have been so strangled by the interest rates, there's no coming back. So some of the big boys are moving in. The first one, Packer, increases rural interest by $10 million. Leading businessman Kerry Packer has increased his already sizable investment in agriculture with a $10 million investment in a rural property trust. He, incidentally, has been accompanied by Mr. Holmes Accord and Mr. Bond, who are all now moving into agriculture. This article came out shortly afterwards, The Weekend Australian, August. Second rural trust putting down roots. The Rural Investment Trust, Australia's newest farm property trust, is making cautious early inroads into Australia's farming industry. During its first 6 weeks, the RIT reported subscriptions arriving at a steady rate of more than $100,000 a week. Subscriptions of $700,000 arrived from Eagle Star Investments. Discussions are being held with several major Australian banks. The trust was established by Challenge Mercantile Limited and Brick Securities as an investment vehicle to buy premier rural properties. The trust manager, Mr. Jeff Chapman, said the market reacted well to the trust and estimated it would take up to 6 weeks for information to filter through to the challenge branches before investment grew rapidly. So the first forays are already being made. 1 week later, Japanese buying too slow. This is the Australian. The surge of Japanese investment in local property markets is expected to last 2 or 3 years. Japanese property investment here is expected to slow considerably after that, with analysts forecasting that the yen will return to its former level of 200 to 300 units to the dollar in about 3 years' time. Well, if there's anything left of Australia in 2 years or 3 years' time, we'll be very lucky, because the governments themselves are now promoting this. This came out in the Adelaide Advertiser just as we moved into 1987, that the New South Wales government had actually established a journal and an office in Japan to sell Australian property in Japan. Japanese investors will be invited to buy some of New South Wales' prime tourist sites. The New South Wales Minister for Tourism, Mr. Cleary, will try to sell the resorts to developers during a trip to Tokyo this week. We are identifying sites on Crown and privately owned land from Tweed Heads to Marimbula, which could be utilized, Mr. Cleary said. I wonder if we've ever had a period in history where we've had Australian governments setting up offices in foreign countries to sell the Australian property we have here in this country. I don't believe that's ever happened before. They might have been attracting people to come out and invest their own lives, but actually selling to foreign ownership deliberately is unprecedented. This was then followed, The Weekend Australian, this is only what, 1 week ago, foreigners flocked to sheep stations. The wool industry is recovering, and with it come the international flies. Australia's booming wool industry has prompted a sudden flood of interest in Queensland grazing properties by overseas investors. And it goes on to say money is coming in from Europe and Asia, hoping to cash in on the wool industry. And so great was the impact of that, that the Bulletin did a special feature article in its issue 2 weeks ago on the huge foreign investment takeover in property here in Australia. Asian investors and new immigrants are snapping up the nation's housing stocks at the rate of $250 million a month, while thousands of Australian families despair of buying a home. That disturbing conclusion emerges from a Bulletin survey of the housing market as it stands poised for another great price surge thanks to easing of interest rates. Many Australians will be left out in the cold because the deposit gap will become too great to jump with the sharp rise predicted in housing prices. Helping to fuel that rise are the hordes of foreign investors now permitted to buy Australian property with scant restraint. They are buying across the continent. from islands off the remote western coast of Tasmania to beachfronts in Perth, from two-rack apartments to canal frontages at Surfers Paradise. Those from whom they purchase them add to the pressure on the remaining housing stock, and as agents in many parts of the country will say, they have very little to sell and lots of takers. Well, that's the result for the poor old farmer. It's now moving on in on the cities. You may be able to lease a house or two, I suppose, or some foreign owner before it's finished, but I'll bet the rents aren't too comfortable by the time it's finished. In the meantime, we're now finding industry itself is moving increasingly into foreign hands. We're even getting the media unable to ignore it any longer. This, for example, came out in August, how foreigners take the cream off our food. And they point out that while ownership of farms is moving out of the hands of Australians, the food itself which reaches the housewife is no longer produced by Australians either. I'll just give you a short paragraph. Foreign companies have a bigger slice of our local food market than they have in most of our other industries. Such traditional fare as cornflakes, Vegemite, foreign owned now. You'll be thrilled to hear. Meat pies, Rosella, tomato sauce are foreign owned or dominated. If you drink Maxwell House coffee, Coca-Cola or Coddy's cordial, you've consumed a foreign product, even if it is made here. Brand names such as Tip Top, Copper Kettle, Clean's, Big Sister, Smith's Crisps, Flora and Streets are foreign owned. Good grief, even Minties have been taken over. Meanwhile, Australian farmers are facing a Waterloo. A special article came out in the Bulletin, February the 10th. This was a little earlier on, but it was simply heralding what is actually happening. One in eight farmers have left the land in the past 30 years. An even greater number is expected to be forced out during the next 30 years. We only have something in the region of 155,000 farmers left. But they've got to go, apparently. They've got to go. In America, in 1950, they had 7.5 million farmers. They are down to 2.5 million farmers now. That is, 5 million farmers have left in 30 years. They are losing farmers at the rate of 1 every 6 minutes in the United States at the present time. And I've been having some correspondence with the editor of one of the biggest agricultural journals, that is a magazine called Acres USA, which some of you might have read, who said that he had an official letter from the Federal Reserve Bank which says that by the middle of the 1990s, they hope to have reduced the 2.5 million farmers down to 100,000. It would be the greatest rural collapse of all time, I'll tell you. It would be a social refugee crisis which has never occurred in an English-speaking country like which we've never seen before, if that was allowed to happen. Well, it's very interesting then to look at some of the bodies that are involved in all this. Because you see, these desperate farmers, what was it, 18 months ago, thwarted by the fact that the marches, which justly protested their plight down in the big cities, never gained any response at all, responded to a call from their own organization, the National Farmers Federation, which said, if you can give us enough money, we will produce a battle the like of which you've never seen to save the family farm. And they set up the farmers themselves in each district to take round buckets and collect money. And we had scenes of up to 200 farmers and farming communities going round their own neighbors and saying, you better kick in or we won't be here. And between them, they collected $15 million, which was more money than all the political parties combined. And there was a great feeling of relief amongst the farmers that this was going to be the means of changing direction and saving what, after all, is fundamental to any community, the family farm. And nothing happened. Nothing happened. Nothing happened. And then that unpardonable, disreputable, shocking League of Rights dared to write an article which said, is it more than coincidence that the man who is head of the National Farmers Federation also sits on the board of a company which appears to be taking an interest in bringing foreign money in for the farm takeover. And it attracted a lot of interest, but it also attracted a lot of condemnation because people said that's the most unfair way to speak about such an honorable man as Mr. Ian McLaughlin. Well, I still am in no position to judge Ian McLaughlin personally. I haven't even met him, but I will tell you the evidence now on what Elders is doing is overwhelming. This article came out July the 20th, called A Halt Decline in Agricultural Trade. I'll just read a couple of paragraphs. Australia is heading towards further severe trade difficulties because it is not taking adequate heed of investment opportunities in international agribusinesses, a government report to be released today warns. Following 12 months of research overseas, the research unit has concluded there is a need in Australia for more companies operating like Elders IXL. Elders has successfully diversified its operations, both at home and abroad, thus transforming itself from a humble jam maker to a world-class transnational corporation dealing in a wide range of products and services. That was the Financial Review, July the 20th. September the 29th, that is what? A week ago, an article in the Bulletin went further. The recognition by Elders of the agribusiness phenomenon has brought the most far-reaching changes to the company for many years. The result is a growing vertical integration by Elders and a strong internationalization of the company. The implications of the changes have barely been felt yet by Elders of Australian Agriculture. However, the company's rapid move in this direction is amongst the best leads Elders has provided the rural sector. Elders Agribusiness is far and away Australia's largest exporter of a range of agricultural commodities, and so on. Gives the whole article on what is happening. That was then followed by this article, which came out in the Australian Business magazine, with a little more on Elders. Fresh from bedding down the Courage Breweries acquisition, Elders IXL is preparing for another splash overseas, beginning with the opening of new international fund management headquarters in London. The shift of Elders Investment Management headquarters from Melbourne to London is, according to EIML Chief Executive Bruce Campbell, the planting of a seed that he expects will carry Elders' reputation into the offices of institutional investors from New York to Tokyo. Campbell and portfolio manager Tony Goss will head to London in March to set up the operation. Coinciding with the christening of their new World Strategy Office, will be an energetic promotion of two fledgling Swiss-based unit trusts and the opening of an administration office in Neuchâtel, Switzerland. The two Swiss trusts are particularly matters of pride for Campbell because Elders is the first non-bank or non-insurance institution to gain permission from Swiss authorities to set up a fund management there. On the board of that company, with its new World Strategy Office in London, and with its two new Swiss units who are hoping to attract investors from every nation in the world to come in here and take over the Australian agricultural scene, sits first of all Mr. John Elliott, who is being touted as the man to lead a revamped opposition back into glorious free enterprise, and alongside him Mr. Ian McLaughlin, who has taken $15 million out of the pockets of farmers under the plea that he is going to fight to save the family farm. And that is why even some of the journalists now are beginning to say the truth. This article came out by David Potts, who I've always thought was slightly dim. He is the economic editor of The Australian, but he lays it on the line in this article, August the 17th. The government has been congratulating itself on reducing inflation and the balance of payments current account deficit, when in fact these have just resulted from the recession. Because consumer demand has been weak, importers have not been able to pass on higher cost due to the depreciation of the dollar. Similarly, less is being imported because consumers are not spending and business is not investing. This recession has suited international currency speculators. Where are we? Who decide the value of the dollar. Now that is very interesting. This recession has suited international currency speculators who decide the value of the dollar. Do you remember that article by the head of the Commonwealth Development Bank last August 1986, in which he warned that he had evidence the Australian money system was being deliberately sabotaged? The head of one of our top banks, and not one politician, not one industry leader, not one leader of any political party even asked for the evidence. And John Fletcher, incidentally, is a very disillusioned man at the present time. But that is now being confirmed by this fact. Similarly, it kept prices down, making Australian assets and shares cheap, while offering very high interest rates thanks to the Reserve Bank tightening of the money supply. Although the high rates did not attract speculators into the bond market, they served their purpose by underwriting the dollar. The money flowed into the share market and property instead.